Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we talk with Gary Smith about his new book, Ice War Diplomat. Gary is a former colleague in the Foreign Service, whose distinguished career included his first posting in Moscow, as well as assignments in New York, Delhi, Brussels, NATO, Bonn, and a stint at Harvard, and then as our ambassador to Indonesia. After retirement from the Foreign Service, he served as a senior executive at York University, his own alma mater, and he now remains active in the community of retired heads of mission, of which we are both members. For listeners, Ice War Diplomat is both a riveting tale of the probably most famous series of hockey games that Team Canada has ever played. I am, of course, speaking of the 1972 Canada-Russia hockey series, played out against the backdrop of the Cold War, an election in Canada, and Gary's own first posting in Moscow. Fresh out of a year of language training, Gary and his late wife, L'Oreal, to whom the book is dedicated, arrived in Moscow, where he served under Robert Ford, our poet ambassador, who understood Russia, but who did not suffer fools. And there's a wonderful tale at the beginning of the book about his first luncheon, the two of them meeting with Robert Ford and his wife. As the junior officer, Gary was given the task of stick handling Pierre Trudeau's initiative, born out of his own visit to Russia and the return visit to Canada of the Soviet premier, Alexei Kosygin, to organize a hockey tournament, 4 games in Canada, 4 games in Russia. It was no easy task given the personalities and the politics. At one point, Allan Eagleson calls Gary a, as Pierre Trudeau would have put it, a fuddle-duddle commie. We all know how it ended 50 years ago this September with Henderson's famous goal, saving Canadian honor. As Gary points out, it was the most watched hockey game in Canadian history. I was in my first year at the University of Manitoba, and I can attest to the cheers that lifted the UMSU building roof. Ambassador Ford would observe in his dispatch home of the series, quote, "I think that no one can safely say that we have come through the last 2 harrowing weeks with Soviet-Canadian relations intact, probably improved, and with the Soviet public and official attention focused on Canada to an extent which must be the envy of all other diplomatic missions in Moscow. Although not all of that attention was good, the end result must be to ensure considerable interest in Canada in every sphere and to facilitate our tack in other fields of endeavor, hockey being just one of them." For his work, Gary would be justly and personally commended by the then Undersecretary, Ed Ritchie. Ice War Diplomat, I can tell you, is a great read. If you like hockey, if you like sports, if you like diplomacy, it's got it all. It's the only book I know that combines a real insight into Canada's great sport as well as diplomacy. It's exciting, it's insightful, and it's well-written. It should also be required reading for all diplomats because it underlines that diplomacy is more than just formal negotiations, but has to include what we now call soft diplomacy, or public diplomacy. Arguably, we need it more than ever before, and as Gary concludes, quote, "Engagement and dialogue remain the foundation of diplomacy. Hockey has been and can again be part of that process with Russia." Listeners should know that I first met Gary when he helped to lead the departmental task force around Pierre Trudeau's peace initiative in the final years before Mr. Trudeau's retirement as prime minister in 1984. I've never forgotten Gary's enthusiasm and passion for getting the job done, nor his ability to use a diplomatic knee or elbow to get the proverbial puck out of the bureaucratic corner or deal with, as Pierre Trudeau put it, the pipsqueaks in the Pentagon. Gary was never a milquetoast diplomat, and in any policy skirmish, he wanted to be on his side of the ice. This is what makes for a successful ice war diplomat. So let's begin. Gary, you are an ice war diplomat. There was no playbook for what you did and how you did it. This was still high risk stuff. You know, the Cold War times, it was just 3 years after the Soviets had shut down the Prague Spring. And as you report, everything you did, including your sleeping arrangements, were monitored by the KGB. But as I read it, it struck me that you had 2 trump cards. First, Prime Minister Trudeau wanted it done, and second, the Soviets, again, Premier Kosygin, must also have wanted it to happen. Is that fair?
Sure is fair, Colin, and thank you for those gracious remarks. I appreciate it. Yes, people say, well, how did this series happen? Series of the century and the greatest moment in Canadian sports history, and the Dominion Institute saying it was one of the 10 greatest events in 20th century Canadian history, you know, along with Vimy Ridge and women's suffrage, the flag, Vimy Ridge. So this is an iconic series, but it just didn't drop from the sky. It had to be organized. And what I tried to tell in this book was how it required a lot of hard work, diplomacy, and politics at the very highest level to get the job done. The biggest impediment was the Soviet insistence on retaining their so-called amateur status so that they could win Olympic gold medals and world championships. And we were able to get around that by calling these exhibition games on a bilateral basis. But it was very, very much something that happened at the top. And as I mentioned in one chapter, Pierre Trudeau and Alexei Kosygin are really the godfathers of this series.
But you were the one that had to make it happen, because I know what it's like. You're the junior officer, and especially when it comes to kind of things that are seen to be sports or cultural or entertainment, they toss it to you. You had to do this. And I'm sure, you know, you were in uncharted waters. You had a passion for hockey. And as you point out at the outset of the book, there was a bit of history between Canada and the Soviet Union as it was then on hockey. Did that help you?
Very much so. I played for the Moscow Maple Leafs, and so I was able in a beer league to get a feeling for Russia. And the Russians love hockey as much as Canadians, so there was some common ground there. And I, speaking Russian helped enormously. But I read about one Russian journalist who had a pseudonym called the Snowman, wrote an article one day in Izvestia that I was, part of my job was to read Izvestia. Anyway, he said that it was now time for the Soviets to play the Canadian pros because they'd beaten everybody else. And I made a phone call to him, and that sort of got the ball rolling between officials, the embassy, and the Soviet sports people, and the series moved on from there.
For listeners, Gary, tell them what the Moscow Maple Leafs were, because again, this is another, I think, testament to your skills at playing high politics and low, getting things done, getting the uniforms and things, that the beer, I think you talk about, because it's a wonderful story in itself, which you tell in the book, which again, I heartily recommend to listeners to pick up a copy.
Well, Moscow Maple Leafs was a team that had just got rolling in Moscow when I arrived in February 1971. And I think within a week of my arrival, I had brought skates with me and I was asked to come out and join the team. And it was an embassy team, but we also had Finns and Swedes on it. And we didn't have a real goaltender, so we found one among the American Marine Corps. And that fellow played goal. And every Saturday we would play the Russians or the Czechoslovak embassy outdoors, Luzhniki and so on. And our tradition was to give a case of Canadian beer to the Russians and let them decide whether they were going to drink it right away during the match or afterwards. So there were some people in the embassy, Francophones in particular, who didn't like the Toronto Maple Leafs, where we got our sweaters from. They didn't like the blue and white. And they said, look, we've got to do something about getting Montreal colors here. So we had a pub in the basement of the embassy, and we needed beer. So I decided to write David Molson and say, hey, how about if we buy 1,500 cases of Molson's beer and you toss in some Montreal Canadian uniforms for our broomball team? And lo and behold, that worked. We got the 1,500 cases of beer. Some of it was stolen, some frozen, but the sweaters arrived. And on Saturday, we wore the Toronto Maple Leaf uniforms, blue and white. And on Sundays, we played broomball and wore the Montreal blue, blanc, et rouge.
Now, when you played the Russians, who were they? Because you talk a bit about it was a mix of of characters as well?
Mix of characters. We often would play the TASS News Agency, the Ministry of Foreign Trade, and once in a while, sort of exotic teams would appear, Accordion Factory number 7 or Accordion Factory number 13. Whoever turned out, it was the same sort of thing, bump and grind and have some laughs, and both enjoying the common element in our relationship. And that's where the diplomacy side comes, is finding something that you have in common. And hockey, both of us northern neighbors, of course, hockey being that common ground.
Now, in putting the book together, did you keep a diary throughout this? Because it struck me you must have gone back and watched all of the games, but the insights, Gary, how did you go back and look at some of your dispatches? Because, of course, this was the day when we used to write dispatches on a regular basis.
Yes, well, I had been at all 8 games, so I had that recollection. And you mentioned Moscow was my first posting, and I like to say it, a first posting is like a first love. You never forget it. You never forget all the details of what happened. But I didn't keep a diary. I really didn't have a lot of time, but I wrote a lot of messages, telegrams, and dispatches. And all those things are available in Library and Archives Canada. It's amazing the files they have there. And I had a researcher, and we went over to the Library and Archives Canada in Ottawa and called out the files. And there were very many of the messages from Moscow, including a lot that I had sent myself. So I was able to fact check a lot of things, because 50 years, memory slips. But with those documents in front of me, the messages from Ambassador Ford and from myself and all the messages that came back from Ottawa to the embassy, I was able to fill in the gaps in my own personal memory.
Now, Ford was a legendary character. Again, a lot of listeners wouldn't know this, but probably, I think, our longest serving ambassador to Moscow, and had a real sense of Russian culture. I recall Alan Gottlieb telling me that after Ford had retired and he was meeting with George Shultz and President Reagan, he offered to George Shultz, who then Secretary of State, to bring Ford over, I guess he retired to France, to talk about Soviet relationships. And they found his insights insightful. And again, it pointed out to me that diplomats with deep experience, knowledge of the country, empathy, language skills, as Ford did. But you worked with him, I guess, it was towards the tail end of his time in Moscow.
Well, he is legendary because he was such an authority on Russia. He had 3 different assignments there and over 16 years on the last one. He was there during Stalin's time. And as you've mentioned, he was a poet. He won the Governor General's Award for Poetry. And he was able to break into Russian cultural society, which provided him with an entree to a lot of thinking of the intellectuals. And because he was dean of the diplomatic corps as well, because he was the longest serving ambassador in Moscow. So everybody beat a path to his door, not just other diplomats in Moscow, but as you say, people in London and Paris and Washington wanted to hear what Ford had to say as we moved through a very difficult period, particularly in the 70s and the late 60s. So he was a go-to guy, very brilliant. He wrote extremely well as a poet and so on. And he was a classic diplomat. And I think I was very, very fortunate to have somebody like him as my first ambassador, because you mentioned he didn't suffer fools lightly. You knew that you had to produce for him and that the embassy in Moscow had standing among Canadian diplomats. And if you were part of his team, you had to live up to his standards.
Now, in the book, you've got some wonderful pen portraits. As you said, you went back to look at your dispatches, but Gary, you have a wonderful way of capturing what these people were about. And these are, you know, whether we're talking the political side or the sports figures. I thought that really makes the book come alive. But my next question to you, this series, it was huge in Canada. And as you say, the Dominion Institute said it was one of the top 10 events for Canadian identity that truly matter. Was it as big a series for the Russians as it was for us?
Absolutely. We estimated that 150 million Soviet citizens watched this series from beginning to end. Soviet television is full of propaganda, and the public get a daily dose of statistics on brick production and so on. So when a sports event comes along, they pay attention. And they knew all their players, and they had heard about Canadian players, these rough, tough guys, being the best in the world. So when this series happened, there was enormous interest. And there was a central committee meeting in Moscow at the time. Getting a ticket was impossible unless you were a member of the Communist Party or had very, very good connections. So they followed this regularly. There were hundreds of Soviet journalists that tried to get coverage for the series. And everywhere you went, people talked about it. And that's why Ford said in his final dispatch that we were the envy of other embassies, because we had used this cultural vehicle to reach out to the Soviet public. And I think that's something very important in, you know, what is cultural diplomacy? Cultural diplomacy is reaching from one culture to another culture and finding those common points, whether it's in film in Los Angeles or in Mumbai or ping pong in China or hockey or chess in Russia. And that's how you connect, not just with people at the top, but the common man and the common woman in foreign countries.
No, and I think that's a point to underline, because what you were doing to me was public diplomacy at its best. And as you say, Ambassador Ford, who himself is a poet, had an appreciation of that. But you got this early on. And you know, you didn't have a playbook for this. You just had to do it, work it through. But it strikes me that, as Ford said, this reaped dividends both short-term and long-term, because I've always saw you as the kind of, when during the Cold War, one of our great East-West specialists who was certainly superb on the political, the economic side. But what always I came to appreciate is that you understood the cultural side as well. And you know, would you agree with me that the cultural diplomacy, which is, I think, sometimes sadly underfunded and underrated within our foreign ministry, really is important for, as you pointed out, because it demonstrates the empathy that you have to achieve as a diplomat if you're going to truly understand the other culture and the nation you're dealing with?
Well, absolutely, you need to understand another country, and to understand another country, you need to understand its culture and its history and its language and its traditions. So very, very fundamental. And in today's world with Ukraine, for instance, I think it's vital for us to try and use as many transmission belts as we can. And that includes through culture and hockey players that are still playing in Canada and the United States, to get our message of truth out to the Russian citizens. So it's a transmission belt for information as well. To reach out to the common person who, let's face it, sports is loved around the world. It's a huge business and there's a lot of politics involved with it. But we need to use cultural diplomacy as well as economic and political and military interactions with other countries.
And what I particularly enjoyed about your book is that you put the focus on sports, but it could just as easily have been popular culture. I certainly came to appreciate this when I was posted in Los Angeles, where music and film, you know, we are players in this, but using it to effect is something that's not always done in diplomatic services. But again, you demonstrate, and this book is probably the best description of how it did improve the Canada-US or the Canada-Soviet relationship, didn't it?
It did at the time. I think one of the problems we have or mistakes we make is that we try and force our agenda on foreign governments. And what we should be doing is looking at what's of interest to them themselves. You know, what matters to them, whether it's a political agenda or an economic or trade agenda. And then we figure out how we reach out to what's of interest to them. That's how you get meetings and you have impact. So you mentioned Los Angeles. everybody in Los Angeles is related to either sports or film and Hollywood. So you can't be talking about exporting furs or something. What you've got to be doing is show how we have interest in sport or interest in film to reach their agenda so that they're happy to have you there. And then once you're there, you have an opportunity to talk about other subjects as well.
No, that's actually, I think, spot on, is that cultural diplomacy is often a tool to enable the larger political economic objective. And again, one that I thought you demonstrate really did work for Canada, and also taking it back to the top level. This was something at a time when the relationships were bumpy, that Canada, you know, established the relationships, which, as you described, that made us the envy of other missions, and certainly would have come to the attention of the United States, and they'd be interested in how we did it as well.
Well, the I often wondered how, in historical terms, how did the Germans, how did they, in their own mind, decide that they were going to eliminate all sorts of people? The mass killings that went on, and how does an individual do that? And I think the history shows that you do it because you hate the other people, that you have a collective hate toward them. And this is Rwanda as well. And therefore, because you hate them, you don't know them, you can say that they're subhuman or rats or whatever, and you can go out and you can shoot them. And I think Pierre Trudeau, the same was with communists. Everybody hated the commies, you know, the dirty commies, the nasty commies. And what this hockey series did, particularly through Vladislav Trajcak, who became a hero overnight in Canada, was to put a human face on communism. And once you've got a human face on the other side, it's much harder to denounce them all and go out and try and kill them all, because you start to think, well, you know, that guy's pretty much like I am. Okay, I start to understand that they may think a little differently than we do, but down deep, there's a humanity there and a linkage there. And I think that's where this hockey series helped very much in the relationship between Canada and the Soviet Union, because for good reason, we have a lot of Canadians from Eastern Europe, and their experience with the Soviet Union is very, very bad. But I pointed out that while they could protest up and down Canada against Kosygin, we didn't face any protests against the Soviet hockey team.
No, that's exactly right. Now, diplomacy is all about relationships, and you had to form a whole lot of relationships during this whole enterprise. And the personalities, as you describe, you know, again, I think of Eagles, and were not always easy, but you succeeded, and you stayed in touch with many of these people over the years. How did that work through, and did it prove useful, again, both personally and professionally, as your career progressed?
Well, yes, I think as a young diplomat, you work your way up the diplomatic ladder, and hopefully you learn some lessons as you go. How do you maneuver among all these things? And you say that I had a sharp elbows and so on, and that's correct, because you see you've got a job ahead of you, and your goal is to make this series happen. And the undersecretary, when he phoned me out of the blue, he said, look, Gary, your job is to keep this series on the rails. And keeping it on the rails meant that I had to give shoves from time to time, but I also had to be on the receiving side of things. So when I'm called a fuddle-duddle commie by one of my own colleagues and fellow Canadians, sure, that stings, but you've got to suck it up and keep moving with what the ultimate objective is here, is to make the series happen, because we want to build common ground with the Soviet Union, and we want to prevent a nuclear war or a conventional war. So when you've got that in mind, all the stuff on the side, you know, you just have to brush it aside. And diplomats, what do they say? Don't burn bridges. No matter how bad things can be, you've got to keep the connections going. And it's amazing, as you move around the world, you start encountering the same people in different locations. And that's enormously helpful in relations and having dinners and talking about the good old days back in Moscow or in Germany or wherever. So it's those personal connections, the so-called idiosyncratic variables, very, very important in diplomacy. And that's why you need to have a personality, I think, that's outgoing and ready to meet new people and new things and keep smiling and keep shaking hands and keep learning and keep listening.
And adaptability is certainly something that you demonstrated throughout this whole affair. And it struck me that, you know, not only, yes, you had to deal with the Russians in a sense as both adversaries, but also the partners in this, but you also had adversaries on the Canadian side that you were having to manage. And again, you demonstrated the ability to stick handle through both sides and as you point out, because you had an objective in mind. And as I guess we said at the outset, your trump cards were this was something that both governments wanted to succeed.
Well, there was a lot of infighting going on in the Soviet Union. And I mentioned that the father of Soviet hockey, Anatoly Tarasov, became a casualty on the Soviet side because he got out in front of the political leadership. And once they made a decision at the top, there was a meeting in the Politburo. They decided they're going to go ahead because there was worry, particularly among Soviet ideologues, that they have this image of Soviet man. And Soviet man is, you know, built out of communism and socialism. He's much greater than the decadent Western man. So they had a fight among themselves. And Brezhnev ultimately said, no, I think we're going to do okay here. We're not going to be humiliated by the Canadians. I think we'll hold our own. So we knew about this infighting going on and who were the people that were the KGB folks and who was controlling whom and how you could get around this. And what was difficult was that for it was 10 years really, we were trying to get Canadian professionals to play against the Soviet so-called amateurs. And we had an agenda. And then once we reached an agreement, I thought it was going to be fairly easy sailing on the Canadian side, but that wasn't the case. There was a lot of infighting among the Canadian Amateur Hockey Association, Hockey Canada that Pierre Trudeau had set up, Alan Eagleson and the National Hockey League Players Association, and then the NHL owners, most of whom were Americans. So trying to get them all working together was very difficult. And we had worked out an arrangement that all communications were going to come from the Canadian side through the Department of External Affairs. Patrick Reed, who was sort of very heavily involved with public diplomacy, and all the messages would come to our embassy. And then we would deal with the Soviets. But from time to time, there'd be freelancing. The Canadian side would send messages in, particularly about whether we were going to play in Prague or not. And so that made it difficult. We dealing with the Russians, their battles, and dealing with the Canadians in their battles. And I think that's where everybody had to have confidence in our embassy, that we were straight shooters, that we would do what had to be done, and that we would communicate in a truthful manner.
Oh, and you underline, which I think is essential for diplomacy, and that's trust. It struck me that you established trust on both sides and that you became the point person that people turned to because they trusted you.
Well, again, that came from the get-go. Knowing, I can't emphasize enough how important it was that I spoke Russian, because immediately you've got an ability to talk to them and listen to exactly what they're saying, no translators or interpreters, and no faulty broken English involved. And then it helped a bit that I could drink vodka without going under the table too. And as I mentioned, I had learned, yes, or was told that the key to drinking vodka is to have fish beforehand, fish oil, herring, and so on, so that you coat the linings of your stomach.
And is that true?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, the Russians are notorious. Good advice. The, yes, Russians are notorious for drinking vodka, and you know, you can have 10 or 20 toasts. They toast everything, and it's chug-a-lug. And many of them end up, they do end up on the floor. And as a diplomat, you don't want to be on the floor in any negotiating, no, situation.
So did you have a favorite fish that you would use to coat pickled herring or something?
Herring, yeah, herring was good. That was available. They had a lot of caviar too, so the caviar helped. It's got some oil with it. Yeah, so that's again working into the local culture. They loved hockey. They loved culture. We had a lot of interaction with ballet and theater and music, because again, those things are very important to Russians. And they sometimes would say to us, "Well, why do you want to bring over the National Arts Center Orchestra or Stratford Festival? It's bringing coals to Newcastle." Say, no, well, this is a new interpretation of things. It's the new world's interpretation. So they'd say, okay. And when Karen Kane and Frank Augustine came over to, you know, they won a prestigious prize at the Tchaikovsky ballet competition. And I was lucky enough to get Karen Kane's tutu out of Soviet customs, because she didn't want to dance without her own tutu. And when I went down to the customs, I knew the way to liberate things was, again, two cartons of Marlboro cigarettes and two bottles of vodka. So those are, again, are all interacting points between Canadian culture and Soviet or Russian culture.
Yes, and having a useful intermediary as you were. Look, Gary, today, you know, I think that the relationship with Russia and Canada, indeed the West, are beyond cold. You know, we're actively supporting, obviously, with arms and money, Ukrainians in their hot war with Russia. You devoted a lot of your career to East-West relations. What's your take on what's going on today?
Well, it's a very unfortunate situation. We should have seen this coming. Putin was laying out all sorts of red lines. NATO encroachment was something that he was going on about. I think what really got under his skin was the Belarusia and Ukraine, because they're both Slavic countries, and the history goes back to, you know, 1000, 1100, 1200, when those three entities were all fused together and were sort of a common entity. And when the Ukrainian leader was forced out of Kiev on February the 24th, 2014, just after the Olympics in Sochi, it was no surprise that when the Russian invasion happened, it was on February 24th, right, 2022, just after the Olympics in Beijing. There's an enormous amount of symbolism in the fact that they're both on the same date. And then when Lukashenko was, you know, in danger of being toppled in Belarusia, he ran to Moscow and got support. So those are two very fundamental areas for Moscow. So what do we do in the circumstances? Absolutely, we need to support Ukraine with lethal weapons. And perhaps we should have supported them with lethal weapons a fair bit ago, not just training, but providing them with stingers and anti-tank equipment long ago. So that's vital. It's important for us to deal with humanitarian situation. I think most of the refugees are waiting to see what happens, whether they have a home to go back to. If the Russians take over Ukraine, I think there's going to be a very nasty culling of Ukrainian citizens. Those who are staunchly Ukrainian are going to have a very, very tough time. And if I was a refugee, I would not want to go back into a Ukraine that was controlled by Russia. So we need to be aware of that. We need to keep pushing on with the sanctions. I think they are going to have a significant impact over time, particularly if oil and gas sales are cut back. We in Canada need to keep doing our best to ensure NATO stays united and that the European Union stay united, because that's extremely important. Putin's going to do his best to break us up, but we have to stay united. And then we've got to come back to this cultural side. There's a whole issue of who's the Nazi here. You know, Putin claims Zelensky was a Nazi and that Kiev was run by Nazis, but the real Nazi here is Putin himself. He's the one invading another country. He's deciding that he's going to be the protector of the Russians wherever they are, just like Hitler said he was the protector of the Germans no matter where they were. And I would say that we need to spend more time finding out how we can get our message to the Russian population.
And does that take us back to sort of the people-to-people contact, the public diplomacy, cultural diplomacy? You know, again, I guess I say, you know, when this war is done, is there also a role for Canada? And I take you back to when I you know, really first got to know you. It was during Pierre Trudeau's peace initiative, and you, you know, you were key in that. You were out there making that happen, and it struck me that Pierre Trudeau had, as we know, he had the presence and he had the contacts. And as we've later learned, Ronald Reagan was actually quietly supportive of what he was doing because of what Reagan himself did later in his career. Although at the time, as I made reference to the pipsqueaks in the Pentagon, it didn't look all that clear at the time. But we did play a useful role. And again, you were leading that and drawing on all your experience. Is that something that Canada should consider again? And as you underline, making use of the people-to-people contacts as well?
Absolutely. We have to make as many contacts as we can. The Ukrainian community in Canada is about 1.4 million. Many of them, indeed many of the Ukrainians in Ukraine, have family connections in Russia. And they've got to keep communicating to people in Russia up and down the ladder. And I'm very happy that we still have our embassy in Moscow. We still have ears and eyes and a voice, because there were some prominent, and still are some prominent Canadians who say, look, let's boot the Russians out of here, which will result in our being booted out of Moscow. And then you cut off those eyes, ears, and voice, and you go back to what Pierre Trudeau used to refer to as megaphone diplomacy, where all we do is shout, and we feel good back home, but it doesn't make any impact at all on the other side. So it's in a sense, it's a useless form of diplomacy. So whatever contacts we have, we need to use up and down the scale. Unfortunately, our relationship with Russia, partly because of Crimea and so on back in 2014, but for some time now, we've been indifferent to Russia, and we haven't put the emphasis on it that we should. And I think whenever Canada has an adversary, whether it's Russia, China, Iran, or whatever, we need to have people who are experienced and are trained, professional diplomats who are trained in those countries, so that we know what's happening and we know who to whom we should address our concerns.
Now, on your point earlier about the demonization of people, if you don't have contact with them, that's, again, I think a vital role. And again, you demonstrated it in spades in Ice War Diplomat by bringing the two cultures, Canadians and Russians, together on a shared sport. And as you point out the book, but I hadn't appreciated that the hockey Canada and Russia goes back to, I think, as you said, 1918, 1919. And so there actually is a long history there. And it strikes me that there's still got to be some kind of appreciation in Russia for Canadian hockey, and certainly in Canada demonstrated through the Canada-Russia hockey series for Russia.
Yes, well, that's what I call in the book, the hockey bridge. And there is a film, documentary film that's going to be done on, based in part on this book. And we wanted to go to Moscow in September, this past September, to do some filming. And initially we were informed that Canadians were on the blacklist in Moscow and nobody was getting a visa. Well, the way we did get a visa to go, the film director and myself, was through writing a letter not only to Putin, but also the head of the Soviet Ice Hockey Federation, Vladislav Tretiak, and had our ambassador convey those messages. And Tretiak stepped up and he said, sure, he organized a visa for us. And we got in and we did our filming and saw him and interviewed him. But that was using the hockey bridge that was created 50 years ago. And the players, they were so-called enemies on ice, but they really enjoy each other's company now, and they love getting together. And it looks like that's not going to be able to happen this year, the 50th anniversary, just because of the adversarial situation in Ukraine. But the hockey bridge, I think, is still good. The Russian tanks have run over it, but I don't think the bridge has collapsed into the river yet. And we still see, as I mentioned, 50 or so Russian hockey players playing on teams in Canada and the United States. They haven't been kicked out. They're there. And there's still a IIHF, the International Ice Hockey Federation World Championship, still scheduled for St. Petersburg next spring. We'll see whether that's canceled or not. But, hockey's a vehicle, and we should continue to use it.
Yeah, and I think you would argue that we should keep these channels open so that, you know, there's been some, I know the couple of sports where we've prevented the Russians, the Belarusians from appearing, but I think you make the argument, and the book again illustrates it, that you've got to keep these channels open, and the sports and cultural side of things are just vital, especially when relationships are as strained as they are today.
Absolutely.
Well, on that, again, Gary, my congratulations on what I think is a must-read book for certainly for diplomats, but also for the average Canadian, because you do a superb job. You know, in your other life, you could be a hockey commentator as well. So let me ask you, what are you reading or streaming these days?
Well, right now it's Bill Browder. Freezing Assets, a new book that's just out this week. And listeners may know his initial book called Red Notice.
Yes.
The huge bestseller on the New York Times list about the turmoil in Russia, the Soviet Union in the 90s, when they were trying to go from communism to capitalism and all the stuff that happened. And now he's talking about Putin hiding money and that he himself, Bill Browder, is on a kill list. So I'm reading that. And I think people who want to know what can happen in Russia, if you read Browder's book and you read my book, I think it helps give listeners and readers an understanding of some of the machinations that go on in an authoritarian country like Russia.
No, and I'll just say, yes, listeners, do buy Gary's book. Gary, thank you, and thanks for listening to this episode of the Global Exchange. We were joined today by Gary Smith, and again, I encourage you to buy and read his new book, Ice War Diplomat. You can find the CJI Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, do give us a rating. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and we will, of course, link to the Browder book that Gary has recommended, as well, of course, as Ice War Diplomat. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to our producer, Charlotte Duval-Antoine, and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on The Global Exchange.